Hello there. This is Matt Hale, bringing you Art Monthly's talk show on Resonance 104.4 FM and DAB and streaming and all kinds of things, and on archive.org with us, and on Art Monthly's website later on podcast, which is where you may be listening now, or, and I don't know, it could be any year at all in the future, probably, while the internet's still running. I'm joined today by two writers who've written pieces in the Art Monthly issue June 2017, number 407. And they are, I'm going to say it wrong, Chris, but I'm going to try and get it right. Chris Fitwasilak.
Fight.
Sorry, knew I got it wrong.
Thank you. No, it's all right.
Sorry,
it's
I should have checked that before the program. Apologies. And also Bob Dickinson, who's come down especially. He's come from Manchester.
Yes, indeed.
Chris is somewhere in London, I think, aren't you, Chris?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, just to be clear, Bob is a writer and broadcaster based in Manchester. Now, broadcasting for the BBC, am I right, when you say broadcaster?
Or I have been known to work for the BBC, yes.
And still or not? Occasionally?
Less so than usual. Less so than in the past, because I've started doing a PhD at the School of Art in Manchester. So that's taking up a lot of my time.
I didn't know that. Oh, that's interesting, yeah. But, and when you were broadcasting, were you... Speaking like we are now on the radio, or were you producing, or both, or
both? Well, I'm more producing, but I have done documentaries where I've presented. I've been the presenter as well.
And Chris, you, turning to you, you got a book. It says here of essays called Ha Ha Crystal, published by Copy Press.
Yes.
What kind of short essays?
The book is short. The essays aren't short.
Oh, no. I see. It's a short book. Of essays that are long.
Yes. But it's, four essays, kind of starting with art and architecture and comic books, and just sort of turning a little bit away from the art criticism mode and more towards just essayistic, frolicking through the woods kind of writing, I suppose.
Thinking out loud in a way.
Yeah, just sort of trying to branch out between a few ideas and see what happens, but also just suggest tools to readers as well.
Okay.
I guess it all started with thinking about speech bubbles as a sort of object.
Lovely things. I've always loved them. I loved drawing them as a child.
Handy things. So, it just kind of grew from there. So it was, just sort of a nice, I could say organic process, but it was painful and long too, but it was fun. So.
And how would people get hold of a copy of that if they wanted to?
Well, there's copies in Foyles, I believe, and Houseman's.
Okay.
And then also just in...
Online?
Yeah, Foyles have... The website,
on the website.
And then it's a Hive, I think, is the more ethical
good stuff.
Place to buy books. So, you can get it there.
And Bob, you've not got a book I've missed. You don't want to plug a book you've written, do you? Have you got any books you've written?
Not for a long time. There was a book.
What was your book?
I wrote a book called Imprinting the Sticks, which came out in about 1996.
Oh, wow.
About the alternative press.
Okay, well, I'm sure it's probably available in some form or other. Most things are still. It's quite phenomenal.
You can get anything online now.
Yeah, which is good. Okay, we will turn to what you have written about in this magazine as opposed to books. And we're going to start with your feature article called Crowd Thinking, Bob, which... I want us to try and just get to the readers an idea of what kind of areas you were trying to cover, and because it's historical and it's coming up to the contemporary and comparing various times and how they're different or the same. It says at the beginning of the article here, it mentions Joseph Beuys being naive, which I thought was quite interesting.
I wrote this article in the run-up to the election that we had last week.
That's just so people who are listening in the future.
Yeah. So
which that is.
My starting point was thinking Theresa May has called an election in which she's hoping for a landslide majority victory that is going to completely wipe out the opposition. And I thought that's not healthy for politics. And I wonder if any artists have encountered this kind of thing before. And we've had several referendums recently, not just in this country, not even a year ago, the EU referendum, nearly a year ago, but the Scottish independence referendum and the big referendum.
And that's just around the Europe.
That's
other places which
places
have had them
as well. Yeah.
Majorly too, which you talk about too.
And I discovered that, artists were commenting on this fact, that on this situation that that politics was, or whole political systems, democratic systems were being threatened, really. The whole idea of democracy was being destabilised by these huge yes or no votes.
The simplification factor
of
is one aspect of that.
And that means the fragmentation of public opinion into two big opposing camps.
Yes.
And
so it's oppositional in a nasty,
Manichean,
simplistic way.
Manichean kind of politics.
Manichean. What's that mean?
Well, you believe either in a black or white universe, or in a good or bad universe.
Which is clearly...
The other guys are the demonic side, and you're the good guys. You know?
Yes. Chris, did you want to ask something?
No,
I'm just
curious how this is going to go, I guess.
So are we all.
Well, no, in the sense of... because in some sense it seems like there's a sort of pessimism about these things. And then I was curious about what... After maybe we discuss this, how it had all changed in the past few days, if it has or not.
Yeah. That's the really interesting thing.
Well, yeah, we do, because obviously, as you were saying, you wrote it prior to what has happened, and what has happened is not what was planned by the Prime Minister.
No, she was not expecting that result, that's for sure.
No.
But I think, Chris, what you were saying about pessimism is the right word, because of when I started writing it, I was personally very pessimistic, but... I wanted to know what these artists who I was discovering, what they were exploring and how their approach to the subject manifested. So, yes, I mean, I started with Joseph Beuys and this sort of it's not surprising really, discovery that he was personally interested in. Experimenting with referendums as a way of living, and as part of his experiment in living as an artist and making everyone an artist who could live better by discovering their own abilities as artists. So he'd grown up in an era of totalitarian referendums under Hitler. So I don't think he was trying to repeat what Hitler had done, even though he'd experienced life under the Third Reich. I think he was part of a kind of, I think Beuys was naive, but he was part of a whole network of, or complex system of networks in Europe and America that were trying to find a sort of countercultural way of replacing Western capitalist-based life, which they were disillusioned with. And I mean, I think Beuys's experiments with thinking about referendums as a way of deciding or making decisions on in life were to do with experiments he did in institutions, in art galleries and in art education.
Yes, academy.
Academies, yes. And he got fired, you know. But so I think he was trying to find structures that were semi-official structures where people could meet and associate and do things like art, and he could use the referendum as a way of making decisions in that kind of limited space.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's very different because it's, as you say, sort of fairly local.
Yes.
So in his history, he'd had Hitler, say, coming to power, eventually maybe using referendums to get there, but they were done throughout the whole of Germany.
Hitler used referendums to consolidate power, and so did Mussolini, so did Franco. Yeah.
But that's on a much bigger scale.
Yeah, I mean, Hitler... when Hitler was Chancellor... became Chancellor, Hindenburg died, who was the president, and Hitler then had a referendum to merge the roles together. And
therefore accumulating more power.
Yeah, so it was... These were referendums to do with, like, huge consolidations, which I suspect to the population at that time would only go to make the state feel more secure.
Yes.
Although I can't imagine what it felt like at that time.
No, I asked you earlier, you know, why would people vote for that?
Yes.
Why? But then you said, well, actually, they were coming out of a very insecure fragmented time
of
the First World War,
yes.
I presume you mean, and that
maybe
led them to go for this seemingly clear, simpler state.
Well,
but we don't know.
Well, I suspect, you know, if you were a part of a persecuted minority in Germany, if you're Jewish, maybe in 1934, and Hitler calls an election, a referendum to consolidate his power, who would you vote for? You might just vote for him because you might think that he's probably the only guy that, if you do that, that you get stability, and he's got to do business with more established centrist politicians who've got to keep him under control. That might be what you did.
Yeah.
But I don't know. But that's what happened.
I'm just saying, maybe we should not use the word stable. No, I don't know. I think, because it's an interesting point to think of, like, why. And I know, you know, I was just thinking of all those referendums that I haven't lived to that many, I suppose. But then the ones where they're confusingly worded, where it's like it's not a yes or no question, but it's presented with a yes or no response regardless. So, you know, people put posters up saying vote no for, you know, whatever emotive reason that maybe isn't the same as the end result. But I was curious whether you were distinguishing also between referendums and, I mean, obviously elections are different, but in the sense of like the way in the article you kind of talk about sort of referendums being kind of counterproductive, maybe your artists working against them, maybe also being counterproductive. Is that the same as elections, you think, or in terms of just like people voting on something?
Well, I think it's, I mean, I looked at, for instance, an artist called Crack Rodriguez, who is from El Salvador, who was protesting about not a referendum, but an election in El Salvador, where there is, there are only two choices, and it's between the FMLN party, which is ultra leftist, and ARENA, which is ultra rightist. And he was really protesting about lack of choice. So it's not a referendum, but it was again an election where you have to make a choice between just two extremes, and he went into a polling station, followed by film cameras, and got his polling card, tore it in two, put one half in the ballot box, and then ate the other half. And the film of it went viral, and he ended up being charged with electoral fraud and threatened with 6 years in jail. And he was sent to jail, but then he was released. And I thought this was a really excellent example of, you know, performance of a performance artist responding to this kind of terrible political situation of a Manichaean choice, and putting his body, you know, using his body to make the point. And I watched, you can see this thing on YouTube. It's really interesting. I've had a look at it, and because he goes into the polling station, which is a school, like, you know, lots of polling stations are, and he's been known for doing performances where he burns school desks as a reference to the murder of students by paramilitaries in El Salvador during the 1970s, which is still kind of a very live issue. And he goes into this school, which is a polling station, and there are school desks piled up in the background. And you think, you know, those things are they're sort of staring at you in the background. And then he does this thing with the polling card, and when he starts eating it, he has to keep chewing it for absolutely ages. It's obviously made of cardboard or something.
Yeah.
And the people behind the desk at the polling station saying, no, 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 no. And then after a while, about a minute or so, and there's lots of film cameras in there, so people must have known he was going to do it. One of the people behind the desk, the woman who's issued him with the polling card, offers him a bottle of sort of grapefruit juice or something to help him. So he drinks it down.
Wash your illegality down.
Yes. But it's a great piece of film.
Must have been quite hard to get the film. You're right. Talking of the voting process, you do talk about quite early on in the piece as well about vote art campaigns, the campaign, which I think is really probably Patrick Brill, Bob Roberta Smith, and others, which was try to get people to vote,
yes,
and be interested in voting. And had a manifesto, didn't it, as well? Which
yes, and they did it in 2015 and 2016, so referring to the general election of 2015 and the referendum of 2016.
Yes.
Getting...
So it's an ongoing sort of thing. But that's artists really associating themselves with the democratic system as opposed to it being unhappy with it and ignoring it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is artists doing a bit of free advertising for the democratic process and for the election process and for, you know, there's nothing wrong with it, getting people to go out and vote. But I think I became more interested in artists who got inside the whole democratic process and started risking...
Using it directly
under quite oppressive circumstances sometimes.
Yeah. Because obviously Patrick's very keen on education and art being involved more or allowed more within schools and all that sort of thing. So he has he didn't stand for election, but I'm surprised in a way. He's the kind of guy who...
I thought he did.
Did he actually stand? Yeah, I can't remember. He's very... anyway, but I was just intrigued with that different approach of artists who are not kicking the system in a way. They're actually saying, get involved and use it.
Yeah,
I think.
I think so. That's right. I think that's right. But I think, you know, in the light of last week's election, what's interesting about that was the Labour recovery, the Labour miracle, has been largely, it is said, due to the work done by Momentum to get young voters out to... And the way they've done that is by using social media. And so vote art is posters, which is fine. I don't know if they use social media.
Yeah, I don't think they use it anything like as much as Labour.
No, Labour have obviously got a good and very interesting sort of machine going there with repeated sort of Facebook messages and postings by Corbyn and so on. And that seems to have worked. Maybe... to the extent that I think, you know, if there is going to be another election, and it looks like there will be another election soon, you know, we're hearing reports that, you know, they just can't wait to
boost their audience figures.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to
literally,
yes,
because it does probably equate in votes eventually.
But yeah, getting young people out to vote is has been a really important thing, and it was very evident that. You know, was working on election day last week when in my polling station in Manchester, that a lot of people were coming out that were younger, and that is a kind of, you know, that using social media like that is a kind of crowd thinking. So when that happened, I mean, I think, you know, in certain ways, crowd thinking isn't just right wing populism. It's not just the effect of the, you know, because we're still in the shadow of Brexit, which is a form of crowd thinking. But the use of social media, which we still haven't explored fully yet, we don't know where it's all going to lead, doesn't have to mean a form of forms of populism that are oppressive and you know, anti-democratic. It could work the other way.
So Brexit was a kind of yes-no vote, referendum, very simplistic, and then the election was supposedly more open, more choices, less... what's that word you use again?
Manichaean.
I love it. Sorry, I don't know.
Well, I think Theresa May wanted
it to
be Manichaean.
Sounds like a rare bird to me. Yes.
Well, it would seem, though, that, like, I mean, I guess if we use the word crowd thinking in that sense and link it to stuff like social media, it does seem to be a sort of like the potential of the crowd, let's say, is a kind of floating potentiality that seems to go either way. You know, you get stuff like Pepe the Frog and, you know, these weird memes that support, you know, where effectively you can elect a president who is happy to be seen as a meme by a certain percentage of people, and that's one version of a crowd thinking.
Yeah.
Whereas, and I think with Corbyn's campaign, you know, he did have memes that were humorous, but also worked politically to his advantage of, you know, these kind of comparisons between him and May and him.
Yeah.
So it's like, I think that sense of, I don't know if it's kind of claiming crowd thinking for one or the other. It just seems to be this sort of shifting instability.
It doesn't mean the death of centrist politics either, because, you know, Macron's Republican Marche Party is a party that's been born out of
big data.
Exactly.
I mean, in France.
Yes.
Yes.
It's a completely new phenomenon that's been, and I think it's again sort of crowd thinking, a result of crowd thinking, and it's introducing a whole lot of candidates and people who have already been voted in who have never been in politics before.
Yeah. Which will, it has to change things, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because Boyce had the German Students Party and the organisation, the manifesto for the Organisation for Non-Voters and Free Collective Referendum. He did try to actually construct some actual semi-proper, are they?
Organisations.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I don't know how big they were or where they were exactly, but how do they... Because, I mean, we don't have people doing that now here, artists, I mean, do we? Really, other than this vote art thing.
No, I mean, I think Boyce had a lot of charisma, and I think he saw himself as a socially connected artist who wanted to engage with communities and wanted communities to change by embracing art and experimenting with art. And so he was... but he also changed. I mean, he didn't...
Yeah, he wasn't the same towards the later part of his life to the beginning.
He moved through his... all those organisations you've just quoted into the German Green Party. And at one time he, as I mentioned in the article, was seemingly sympathetic towards the Red Army faction, Baader-Meinhof.
Who you described, and they really are quite extreme, radical organisations.
Yeah, they were a leftist...
certainly violent.
Violent group. That. I mean, I think a lot of people on the left were in Germany and in other parts of Europe sympathetic to groups like that at that time.
Mm.
There was, it was the period of the rise of the IRA in Ireland and Red Brigades in Italy. So that was the way a lot of people in the new left were going.
It is all pre-internet, all that stuff. It's quite interesting in a way to me, because I was just thinking, well, you know, if you don't have any way of getting anything changed and everything's going, so you might turn to violence. Whereas now, maybe you turn to this crowd, internet, another way in which you have a massive change, effectively, which
troll people constantly.
The Tories didn't really know how to deal with. They don't. They're no good at that, it seems.
Well,
I'm sure
at
they'll
the
hire someone.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, no. Yeah, they may. They may. Chris, you were going to come in a bit earlier.
Well, I was just saying, because with your point about Boyce, I might have to disagree with you in the sense that, I mean, I think he had a big infrastructural influence and in that, you know, like traveling around trying to found these different free universities. I know, like in Ireland, he helped set up like Circa magazine and stuff like that. And so, like, I think your point was more about infrastructure and setting up organizations, I guess. And I think there are a lot of artists actually working. I mean, people like Ellie Harrison in the
UK. I'm sure, though. I was thinking immediately, I'm sure I'm wrong about that.
Yeah, it's also that thing of, the more people doing kind of socially engaged art, I think they found they have very quickly find they have to engage with systems and structures before they can engage with people often. So it's, I think, more and more there's people working with those sorts of systems.
Well, I have to give the oil protests in the Tate. I mean, for instance, I mean, that's that's an organised group of people, and they are having to deal with a massive organisation, the Tate, and BP, aren't they? And that, so it is. That.
Well, anyway, that was just a wider point, but I think, yeah.
Jürgen Habermas, should we mention him?
And now to Habermas.
Well, this is just that. This is the idea of the public sphere that Habermas, German philosopher and critic, who's still alive.
Yes, I noticed that today on Wikipedia. I was a bit surprised.
Yeah,
by that.
He's talking about the way that you have, because of the birth of the bourgeoisie in the sort of late 17th century, early 18th century, with coffee houses and the popular press, you have a kind of a public sphere where rational discourse can occur, logical, rational, embracing science and a shared understanding of the way the world works and the way the world is. And then his argument is that towards the end of the 19th century that starts to break down because of the birth of the popular press and the power of consumerism.
And mass media coming in.
Yeah.
Printing and all that.
Yes. Right. And I wanted to bring that in because of this work done by Bojana Cvejic and Anya Vujanovic, who are young artists from former Yugoslavia, from Serbia, who did this piece in 2012 at Tate about, which was called The Public Sphere by Performance. Well, the book they produced was The Public Sphere by Performance, and the work they did was called Spatial Confessions, which was a form of social choreography, and it involved using the public who visited Tate Modern to take part in experiments in which they had to respond to yes or no questions, like do you live inside the centre of London or do you live outside the centre of London? How would you describe could you arrange yourselves in the room from right to left in terms of your skin pigmentation? So these were sort of experiments where people actually visually moved around in the space.
In answer to specific questions.
In answer to specific questions. And I thought that chimed in with the idea of a referendum, using very simple questions.
Reflecting it, in a way.
Yeah, and so in a way, they're looking at it because of what, in their experience, happened to Yugoslavia. And so there is this film that they produced, which we have some stills from in the magazine, Yugoslavia, How Ideology Moved Our Collective Body, by Marta Popovoda. And takes you through a series of public manifestations in Yugoslavia from 1945 with partisans demonstrating with Red Star banners in Belgrade, in the streets of Belgrade, through these enormous public choreographed celebrations that happened all over Yugoslavia in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, through to the demonstrations and the violence of the 1990s and the downfall of Milosevic's government in Belgrade at the end of that period of fragmentation and
which some of these horror. Artists in the Tate experienced.
They
will certainly know a lot about.
They will have lived through it. I don't know if they were all there at the time. Many artists at that time had to leave.
Did they make art about that then?
Well, I think what they're talking about is look what happened to our country. Look at what happened to this. The public sphere in our country was very, very specialised, and it was public. It embodied in human bodies doing these vast choreographed things, manifestations, actions, and in a way, at the time, if you're there, you don't notice how unusual it is. Mm. But when you put it all together into a film, you can see how that one state, that one state of Yugoslavia, which was an experiment, how it was born and how it died, just through those explorations and manifestations in the public sphere. So they're taking it, they're taking their ideas and bringing them to Britain, where our experience of the public sphere is maybe a bit different, but because we haven't lived through we're not Yugoslavia, but nonetheless, the public sphere is a different thing from the middle of the 19th century or from the 18th century. And we've been talking about how the internet and social media are affecting our public discourse. And I think that's one associative point. But I think what they were doing, these artists at Tate Modern, was a really odd thing as well, because it was in this huge space, getting people to move about and be choreographed and therefore be a kind of an aesthetic object that actually does say something about the way we live, but it's very controlled. It's incredibly controlled.
And people did it.
And people did it.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? They did it.
Yes.
Because, I mean, not everyone would. I mean, some people wouldn't do it because they were sort of English and shy. Or
yeah.
Other people wouldn't do it because they wouldn't want to be controlled like that. Or they might see over it or not be playful.
Way,
or, I mean, all kinds of reasons.
In a weird way, it's asking people to be sort of temporary Yugoslavians.
Yeah. Which is useful learning.
Temporary mid-1960s Yugoslavians. We're going to do this big fun thing where we do something all together, and it looks and it has a certain aesthetic appearance, but it does say something about the way we are.
Yeah, and where we are now, right outside this place at the moment, is in a no real government situation, which is everything to play for, really, in a funny kind of way, isn't it?
Well, there's going to. I mean, we have been talking about this, haven't we? I mean, who knows what's going to happen? It's going to be another election, I would have thought.
The heading of the book that Chris reviewed, the title of it, is called Tell Them I Said No.
Smooth shift, yes.
Well, I say no to Mrs. May, but I don't think she's going to hear me. But you never know. Chris, you reviewed one of our writers' books. Martin Herbert writes for various places, and originally Time Out magazine, I remember him years ago. But he's written for Art Monthly lots, but he's also written a book called Tell Them I Said No, 2016, by Sternberg Press. And you have reviewed it.
Yes.
Would you like to sort of tell us a bit about...
Well, so it's a short series of anecdotes, I suppose. There's, I think it's 10 artists that he looks at, of artists who decided to leave the art world, which is an interesting kind of conceit in itself. It's like, okay...
I think it's a very interesting one, actually.
Yeah, this idea of, you know, people who decided to just... either not be involved with their work anymore, just got sick of it. In some cases, people who just kind of moved to the middle of nowhere. In some cases, death.
So kind of removal, but they carry on making work.
In some cases, yeah. But also, that sense of distance, let's say.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, Martin's a great writer, so it's a pleasure to read. So but it's also interesting to think about on that level of just what we do in Art Monthly and what we do writing in terms of delivering art to readers in some sense. And so it was just interesting to think on that level of what this book is actually doing in terms of taking stories we might not know, or, you know, that kind of distance between what these people decided to give up and kind of bringing that to us instead, let's say. It's an interesting set of cases. I mean... there's kind of more well-known ones, like Agnes Martin moving to Santa Fe, or not Santa Fe, but out in New Mexico.
Yes.
And then people like...
Presumably from the city.
Yeah, she'd lived in New Mexico for a while, but then she went to New York, did a lot of work, and then left again.
Yes.
And I think that back and forth kind of embodies a lot of this stuff, in the sense that people went somewhere and then decided to leave. And that usually ends up being a place where... you know, these kind of art metropolises. A lot of those contradictions of going, okay, that means we actually know who these people are in the first place.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a key thing, isn't there, which I think comes up, is this idea that to remove yourself, you have to be already
to be there
in, and to be recognised as having removed yourself, you have to be known.
Yeah, to be on the stage in front of a public before the empty stage becomes apparent as a thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Ask Tommy Cooper.
Yeah. So it has this kind of theatrical conceit to it, but it works quite well in that sense. So once you kind of give it that, and some of these artists are kind of, you know, it's like, I guess like Christopher D'Arcangelo is quite an interesting character, and not that much has been written about him. And that I found I really enjoyed. But also figures like Charlotte Posenenske, if I pronounce that correctly, who's one of those people that you see her work constantly, and, you know, I've always admired the modularity of it, but I actually wasn't shamefully aware of the kind of dimension of her work. And her, so she gave up work to be a sociologist and was interested in, like, the sociology of the factory and working conditions. And so that was always in her work, but she kind of just took it that next step further.
So she was kind of almost true. She removed herself by being true to her thought process,
yeah,
as it were.
Yeah, following it that next step further.
Yes,
so in
yes.
some cases, it's part of the work. Or, like, say, with like, Trisha Donnelly and David Hammons, you know, where it's like they're just not interested in them. Well, I guess David Hammons, obviously, he's got his self-portraits in some cases, so he is part of the work, but he doesn't. And maybe his antagonism towards the art world is a character as well that he projects, I think, in some cases. But where, say, like Trisha Donnelly, where there's a deliberate distance that enables the artist to then kind of be deliberately elusive character, let's say, within their own work somehow. So that kind of choice to almost fictionalize themselves, and that distance being a means of fictionalization, I suppose. But I don't know. I mean, it's just it was fun to read and think about, just because there is always that thing of, you know, you wonder about the mechanisms by which we learn about art and artists. And
do you think it revealed those?
Well, in some cases,
quite well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I guess when I wrote the review, I was kind of like, well, do we need to talk about people like Hammons and Donnelly who have these big public careers? And to me, there's this sort of like fayness about that. It was like, oh, you don't really need to know who I am, really, you know. But then they have obviously had to push themselves a lot to get to that point, to be able to then pull back. But then it's interesting, that isn't to discount the commercial sphere entirely, to say like, okay, this fictionalization or this performance of leaving happens in multiple ways. So I guess it's kind of also necessary to include figures like that to kind of think about it as a conceptual move, I suppose. If that makes sense.
Yeah. I was thinking of Baz Janada, who went off in a sailing boat and was never seen again.
Yeah. Well, see, I mean, because you talk about this and it's like, yeah, Lee Lozano or Duchamp just, you know, becoming a chess player sort of thing. It's like these are the well-known cases. And I think Herbert sort of deliberately sidestepped
that,
which is good.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then, I mean, I'd never heard of Albert York, and, you know, so it's good to think about in that way.
Yeah.
It's funny, like with Lutz Bacher, again, I think it's like a deliberate elusiveness, but I don't know, to me that it's not necessarily disappearance as such, it's more kind of just playing, but yeah.
I'm fascinated by this idea that you're saying about that you think that your idea that the job of the art writer is to bring art to the public, I think you said, and what this is about bringing the artist to the public. Is it the art or the artist?
Well, I think that was the question I ended up asking myself, is like, okay, what are we doing here this case? And as Herbert, as a fellow critic, is like, okay, what? And because a lot of this book is about him attempting to glean their reasons. He doesn't necessarily talk to them directly, but he's
you said that was interesting, that he didn't actually meet them, but he tried.
Well, in some cases, he started to, and then he kind of realized that wasn't the point, I guess.
Okay, right.
So,
because the point is to write about absence.
Well, or to dwell on that absence.
Making absence into a thing.
Yeah, well, but in this case, it's not so much about just looking at the work, it's looking at the artists. Yeah. And so it was interesting, the choice that he made in that sense to sympathize with the artist's role in this process, when I guess in my own case as a writer, I tend to just try to sympathize with the work and forget about the artist,
right,
let's say.
Yes.
So I guess that's the choice, I guess, I see. And it was kind of thinking about on that level. It's like, it's not just that we are introducing readers to artists, but that we're bringing art to their attention in a certain way, I suppose. Not necessarily the artist, but the art, I suppose. And there, I guess I do see a distinction. And so this book is very much about the artist. But then, as we were saying, you know, where it's fictionalized and that sort of thing, it is where the art and the artist are intertwined. And so there is no distance between the two, but them stepping away is kind of like turning that distance into material for the work.
Yeah, because a work of art done by an artist who's dead is not the same. It doesn't feel conceptually the same to me in my thinking about it as a work of art where you think that there's a work of art and the artist isn't here because they've walked away from it and they don't want to be part of it anymore.
Yeah.
That's a weird one.
But I was thinking about that in terms... I mean, I guess D'Arcangelo's... Well, several of these artists have passed away, but it's that idea of, okay, what's the difference between an artist who chooses to walk away and is dead or an artist who is just dead, and then what's the state of their work after that? You know, and it's a quandary that every museum has to deal with, but then those are... I mean, by the same token, if we're thinking at that infrastructural problem, like they had to get in the museum in the first place as well in order to be looked after. So then it becomes that thing of like, there's, you know, we know that 99% of the art in the world doesn't get to that point. So I think it's an interesting thing to dwell on of like, why we know about these people in the first place. And so, yeah, there's a lot of contradictions, and it's nice.
And with Bazdan Adda, for instance, I mean, there's a kind of mysteriousness and about his disappearance, which kind of, I mean, maybe he's better known because he disappeared. And maybe you know more about all of his work because that weird disappearance lends some sort of weight almost as well to, well, what did he do before all that? And he was willing to take that risk. I mean, even if it was actually an accident, and even if it wasn't even necessarily an artwork, it seemed to fit that he did disappear on a sailing boat in the middle of the Atlantic somewhere, and then you look much harder at all the early stuff. I was just thinking when you were talking about that, it's probably a red herring, but this, the level of removal of the artist can also be at the level of within, you talked about the work or the artist, but within the work, the reduction of the touch of an artist within work, or the minimal, just the whole way that you can remove to degrees. So you could remove your whole self, but also you can remove your
with Pozanenska, that was part of her point, you know, having these modules that could be arranged in any point by any way.
So, by anybody.
Yeah.
Yes, which again is, yeah, that's exactly what I mean, yeah.
So it's that thing of, yeah, I think she wanted to remove herself and kind of share that experience of it. But then I think then deciding to remove herself entirely and not having to do anything with the work, basically. the book's kind of structured interesting in that sense, where it begins with painters, so that the touch is, you know, the hand of the artist is quite present, and then it kind of moves through conceptual artists. And so, yeah, it's almost like the hand is kind of getting further away in some cases, but then sort of fictionalized at the end.
But it's just
interesting, I guess, for me to think about, you know, like what are we doing? Or, I mean, the way I started the review is just that sort of question you have in the pub of just like, you know, how many great artists ever existed that we never heard of, you know? And I'm sure there's millions, basically, just with the structures of these things. So
it does depend on how you define the words,
yes,
doesn't it? Because obviously, are they, if they're not known?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's just
I guess I'm just thinking of, like, amazing work that we've never...
Yeah, now that's different. I think amazing work...
Yeah.
It's just the artist is...
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's lots of that, I'm sure. I still think it's very arguable because...
Of course, yeah.
What is art if it isn't seen or doesn't have some reaction to it publicly, or is it? I don't know. I always think it isn't myself, but... When I've gone, you'll get all those paintings out of the attic and think I'm great. Shall we try?
But you haven't walked away from it, though, have you?
No, I definitely haven't. No, despite the fact that I have a studio in a wood by a pond in a very quiet place in London, I haven't walked away from it because it's only actually very near a tube station, really. But so, can we just? We haven't got loads of time, but I'd be nice to mention you both did two other reviews. One was at Oriel Mustin, and that was by Chris, and the show was called Wagstaffs, and it was sort of a music-based one, and we might get to that if we quickly... But it was a good show, and Chris did like it. But I just also... because we've just been talking about something Chris wrote, let's go back to Bob quickly. Bob, you reviewed a show by Victoria Lucas, Slayer of the Land and Other Such Myths, which was Airspace Gallery, Stoke-on-Trent, in the Potteries.
A place I used to live near when I was a teenager. So, but it's become very deindustrialised since I was a teenager. So it's...
There's less pots made.
There's very few pots made, and there's no coal mining or steel anymore. So it was a famously a very high Brexit voting part of the world as well. So it has a high number of brownfield sites, which used to be factories or shops or whatever. And so Victoria Lucas, who's an artist who's based in Sheffield, has been referring to a brownfield site, which is right next to the Airspace Gallery, which is a really great place to go. It's a really good gallery, actually. I think it's a converted shop. It's a really long, narrow kind of space. And she filled this space with basically photographic work that she'd done in the California desert and coloured in sort of wild, psychedelic, lurid colours and installed along with these huge polystyrene gold-painted boulders. So creating a kind of very kind of science fiction-y feel to the gallery, but referring to the brownfield site in this film called Concrete Island, which you go and see at in a little projection room at the back, and using some of the sort of sound effects that were produced in relation to Concrete Island, which is a reference to a book by J.G. Ballard.
Yeah, about the man who gets stuck in the middle of a motorway and can't get away from the bit we all drive around and look down on and spit on and chuck things in.
That's right. Well, she went to the brownfield site next to the gallery with a group of female singers from local community choirs, the Keel Women's Community Choir and the Loudmouth Women Group. And they did this sostenuto singing, which means that they all produced notes, and we could do it now.
We could do. We might get thrown out of the studio in a minute as well, I think, but keep going. Go on.
I produce a note, and you produce a note, and you produce a note.
Okay. Yeah.
And I'll go, we'll go now. Keep going, breathe in when you want to breathe. So what you do is you overlap your voices so that there is no break in the actual sound.
Oh,
so
I should say.
Each of us can
so it's constant.
Yes, so it's constant.
We failed at that, didn't we, then?
Well, no, these women did it really loudly and really beautifully, and they'd rehearsed it. And it's a feminist statement, and they did it as a performance in the studio, in the gallery. So it works as a kind of
talking of music.
Peace.
Or a Mustin. We're getting quite near the end of the show, so I'm being very crude here.
It was a big group show, but it was based on the fact that the physical gallery space at Mustin did used to be a piano shop.
Yeah, that was interesting. It's a lovely space. It's a huge place, though, for a shop.
Well, and it was actually, they had the space next door and that, and so it was filled
full of grand pianos, I suppose, originally.
Apparently. And so the shop has continued to be next door after the gallery started again within that space. So it was a nice little touch because basically they just had lots of archival material from the shop itself and from concerts that had been given in Clandudno over the years that were organised through the people who'd worked in the shops.
They're very good at getting in touch with their locals. I went to see a show there, I can't remember the name of it now, but they had all the youth come in doing skateboarding up the walls and stuff like that. And it was great, actually. It really worked well.
Well, this is part of a series where they were looking at the history of the space. So it did used to be, I think, a postal sorting office or something like that as well. So there was one show that had been based on that, using mail arts. There's been a whole series of these shows. So this is kind of, I think, the second in that series, or maybe the third. So it's just... it's got some kind of bigger names, but then it's undermined by all this kind of jumble of stuff. And there was, you know, older people coming in, kind of going, remembering the shop. And so there was a nice sort of back and forth. I mean, a few tokenistic pieces, but generally the atmosphere kind of retained it as something that was sort of lively and had a sense of humor. And
well, just as a very basic question, it was about music, or because it wasn't. You wouldn't come in there and it was all music playing. So how is it about music?
You would come
in
and there'd be like some techno playing from one.
So you did hear
track,
some,
and then there's the Hannah Rickards Thunders piece that would come in every once in a while, and then there'd be the Henry Sella
drums.
Oh, so
it's quite audible.
Yeah, there'd always be something kind of chipping in. Yeah, so it was, and the whole place was kind of visually jumbled as well. I mean, it was organized into different sections, but it was kind of. And some pieces were meant to be more instruments, and some people were more about music. So it was a range of approaches to music, maybe not music's relationship to art necessarily, but more art being made around the idea of music, I suppose.
That's great. I think we're going to call it a day. It's been a great show. I really enjoyed it. Chris Fite Wasilak and Bob Dickinson. How
That's
did I do?
Correct.
Better
good.
Than at the beginning, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
The name check, I mean.
Name checks.
Dickinson.
Name checks.
Fight. Okay. Thank you, listeners, for being with us again. And you've been listening to the Art Monthly Talk Show based around the June issue of Art Monthly 407. You can catch it again on podcast on Art Monthly's website, www.artmonthly.co.uk, where you can also subscribe. We hope you do. And then you can read these texts. Goodbye. Thank you. And I'm now going to bring you in some music, which is Benedict Drew's LP Crawling Through Tory Slime, which is connected with a show they currently have on at the Whitechapel Gallery this summer. And I won't go on reading all this out. There's too much stuff here to read out, but it'll be interesting. Listen to the music, if it is music. Goodbye.